All right, we are back with another edition of the Work Week After Hours, and I've got my wingman here, Steve Cadigan, and today we have our first guest ever on the Work Week, Steve.
I know, and what a guest we have. The listeners are in for a big treat. We have Shahar Erez here coming to us live from Israel. And I don't know how we're able to get on his calendar because an entrepreneur is a busy, busy person. So, Shahar, welcome. And we're so excited to have you on the program.
Thanks. I'm humbled. Wow. First guest. Well, the reason you have me here because it's Friday night, almost 10 p.m. That's why I'm available. It's not my last call for the week, but that's why.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So, Shahar, do you want to, if you will tell the listeners and viewers a little bit about who you are, maybe a little bit about your journey into where you're at, and then kind of what you do now.
Sure, gladly. I'm 46 years old, almost 46. I've been in the industry for about 22 years. I was a software engineer. By the way, against all odds, I graduated high school. Well, officially graduated high school when I was 22. That's when I completed my high school diploma. I didn't wake up to my end of 12-year test back then. I wasn't interested. So after I graduated my almost 5-year military service, I got my diploma, got into computer science, got full scholarship, and you know, that's how I made my way into the industry. Spent a bunch of time in startup companies. Got acquired into HP in 2006, which ended up leading me into relocating California and integrating kind of a couple of different product lines. Worked for VMware for a few years, led product acquisitions, investments in the DevOps space. Flew back to Israel after 5 years. Ran product marketing growth for a company called Kenshu. 3 years ago, I started my existing company called Stoke. That's pretty much who I am. Three kids, 16, 14, and 11. So nice. I guess that's the most important part.
Well, I definitely want to hear more about Stoke. But before we do that, you and I've spoken before, and I've had a few visits to Israel over the years. And one of the things that really struck me was how the military service is almost like a training ground for some of the startups that that Israel is prolifically generating. What was your experience there? When you go into the military service in Israel, is there an expectation that, okay, you know, yes, this is going to be hard and I may face some difficult times, but I'm learning and I'm going to grow and the country's investing in my technical development? Was that part of how you saw that?
I wasn't doing anything technical in the military. I was in the field. So I guess there's two sides to the military service. Those that go into the technology units. When I was drafted, this is 93, it was still early days for the tech community here. Mm-hmm. So there were very selected few that went into the technical roles, if you will. The founders of Checkpoint back then, Mercury, it's like the early days of the tech industry. Now there's a lot more, and there's a huge number of military graduates that are getting into the industry very well prepared to be part of the tech ecosystem. But I also think that on the non-tech units, a lot of the people got a lot of different assets that helped them become entrepreneurs. Facing difficulties, to your point, you know, unknown ground, having to face, you know, changing landscape, having to figure out how to lead people, making decisions, you know, under fire, not necessarily real fire, but under stress. I think a lot of those virtues come into play when you're starting a business or playing in any business. So I think doesn't matter where you served. I think it gives you a lot of very good confidence as you're rolling into these positions. I never thought about this. The country's investing in me. I don't think that's how we thought about it. but I definitely gained a lot by that experience.
Mm-hmm. And so tell the viewers, listeners around Stoke Talent and what you're doing. And all, if you can, tell us, were there indications earlier in your work journey that led you to sort of say, yeah, this is something I really want to do? Like, what were some of the experiences you had, the awakenings, if you will, that sort of led you to found the company?
You know, I think there were a lot of points throughout my career that kind of led me to understand or kind of understand the trajectory of where the work market's heading towards. I worked for corporates, Mercury, HP, VMware, and decent organizations. And it always struck me as someone who wants to make things happen, right? You get into corporates, by the way. A very significant percentage of people within corporates are just coasting. It's just the way things are. They're just coasting in their career. They're not really there to make a change. They're there because, you know, it's okay. It's a good job, decent pay, decent benefits. So we'll just be
there. We call that career playing career defense.
Okay, exactly. So, by the way, in HP, mm-hmm. Its structure doesn't exist anymore. So I can say in HP, it's like 80-90% of people were there. It's like it's another job. I don't really care what happens. I'm not trying to change anything. Mm-hmm. You know, coming from Israel, I was young back then. I was like, let's get things done. And you run again and again into the corporate structure and decision taking that it's almost impossible to make things happen. And what we're seeing over the last, I'd say 20 years, probably before, but I'm seeing it in the last 20 years, is that notion of acceleration. Everything's happening faster. Decisions need to be taken faster. Technology is changing faster. Go-to-market needs to change faster. Competition is moving fast. Everything is happening at a higher velocity. And for organizations that are still operating in a very slow decision-taking process, it's almost impossible to win. It's like it's almost written on their back, you're about to die. And I actually remember when I was at HP, and I think 6 months after getting acquired into HP, HP acquired EBS back then, if you remember back in, mm-hmm. there were like consulting companies in Texas.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. exactly. Mm-hmm. So HP was 160,000 people. They acquired EDS, which was another 150,000 people. All of a sudden, I got an organization of 300,000 employees. It's like there's no way for this thing to move unless you put the right people, the right structure. And I was in the software business unit, and we started seeing that the industry is changing. Amazon came up with EC2 back then. VMware was becoming more and more proliferant in organization. We thought we need a complete new strategy to how HP operates within data centers. And we were talking to management, and they were like, we don't see that. It's like, you don't see that because you're talking to CIOs that don't understand the changes that are happening in industry. And, you know, for 12 months, we're trying to get them to understand that the world is changing, and they weren't able to grasp onto that change. Even after I left, it didn't happen. And it got me to realize in HP and then in VMware again, when I joined VMware, it's still a very agile organization, and it's grew, it became difficult as well, that we need to get to a point where there's a lot more autonomy to individuals within the organization, teams, BUs, whatever you want to call it, that can make decisions quick, drive to execution. And if I realize there's a change, I need to hire that person or this person, I need to move people around, I need to be able to make that decision without going like, you know, climb up the org ladder to make any decision. When I moved back to Israel in 2013, I actually bootstrapped a company. And bootstrapping a company, you know, some people will tell you it's the best way. Doesn't matter. I'm not.
Tell some people may not know what that is. Tell people what bootstrapping is.
Oh, sorry. So when you found a tech company, there's two ways. Either you go and ask for money from someone, angel investors, private investors, or you go to institutional investors, venture capital firms, and you raise whatever, hundreds of thousands of dollars, millions of dollars, whatever it is, depends on how you want to structure your business. And then you can start hiring people, build a product. Bootstrapping means you do everything I just said, but without any funding. So you collect a bunch of friends or people that will moonlight. You work overtime, you work nights, you work weekends, and you try to get something together. Shane is laughing. I think Shane has built a few bootstrap businesses. You can see the scars. See, yes. Maybe that's why both Shane and I don't have hair. We lost our hair because of bootstrap company. Listen,
yes. There's an inherent trauma that goes along with it. And there's an inherent education that goes along with it too. But
By the way, I'm not, some people tell it's the best way. I'm not advocating one way or the other, right? There's a lot of comfort in raising funds from VCs. Okay, I got a few millions to build a business, but then you got a bunch of VCs asking you, what are you doing with my money?
Yes.
So there's a downside to that as well. It's not, there's no perfect solution. It really depends on what you're trying to do. But back to the story. So, you know, I was bootstrapped a company. I couldn't afford hiring employees. And so my co-founder and I, by the way, it's the same co-founder that I'm working with right now. We started searching for freelancers, you know, pay per project kind of work. It was early days of the marketplaces. This is 2013. Fiverr was just getting started. Upwork, I think, was still Odesk back then, or Elance. You know, it took us some time to figure out what does it mean to start working with freelancers, because we grew up in corporates. We're used to interviewing people, taking them through a process, asking them questions, taking weeks to hire. It's like, you know, we needed someone to do some work for us for a few days. Like, I'm spending a cycle of interviewing that person. Doesn't make sense. And so after a few weeks, we got into this cadence where it's like, you know, screw that. It's like, okay, we're not going to spend that much time. We're going to give the project to someone, give them a small project for a few $100s. If they're great, we'll continue. If they're not, we're never going to talk to them again. But it's like, instead of spending cycles interviewing them, let's just get them to work. And 3 months later, we had 18 people working for us. In New Rochester, New York, Bangladesh, India, Pakistan, people that did work for us for 48 hours, literally. They took a small project in an area of code that we didn't understand. I don't understand anything code, but generally speaking, my co-founder needed something. And so he found someone doing it, something for 48 hours. People that collected data. I had a designer that worked with us for 8 or 9 months. So we really had a variety. And it wasn't about saving money. Obviously, saving money is important. But the thing that amazed me most back then is that I made a decision that they need something. And 2-3 days later, someone started working on that. Steve, you saw a few HR organizations in your time. From the moment someone says, hey, I need headcount, until there's a butt in seat, what's the average time?
I mean, the expectation is it's weeks, in some cases months, before you're going to realize the number one, the hire, and then the two, the onboarding, and then the be able to be effective. It could be months. Yeah.
And so for me, the ability to make a decision and start seeing results, again, maybe it's not perfect. Maybe it's not the same person that you would have hired full time. Mm-hmm. But I always say 70% of something is far more than 100% of nothing. And so that got us into developing this agile mindset. You know, you have these big signs at the Facebook headquarters, you know, fail fast. Like, okay, let's fail fast. Not just say the words. Let's get someone going. Let's give the job to someone. If they're great, we won big time. And if they're not, then we lost a few $100s on the experiment. It's definitely worth it. And that changed my mindset. Fast forward a couple of years later, I was at Kenshu. And I kind of said, I want to bring that mindset into the organization. Now, Kenshu was a 600 people company, not a very large organization. It was impossible to execute because I took over as CMO and I kind of said, I think the marketing organization isn't what we need to grow. We need different type of DNA. And so I fired half the marketing team and took the dollars and deployed them into freelancers. And within 3 months, we tripled all of previous year's leads. And I'm not some guru marketeer. You know, I'm an Israeli boy from a town called Petah Tikva. Trust me, there's nothing in my resume that would testify that I'm some great marketeer. But what I've done was brought the talent that the company needed. I couldn't afford these people full-time. I got an SEO expert for a day a week and an SEM expert for a day a week, a couple of graphic designer, content writers, someone to clean up Salesforce, someone to write out email. I had 12 people instead of the 3 or 4 that I had to let go. And these 12 people did exactly what we were missing. And so instead of taking someone like Shane, no disrespect, and kind of saying, well, Shane, you know what? On top of everything you're great at, I actually need you to become a content writer. Yeah. Maybe you're great at content writing, or maybe you are.
No.
And then I throw it at him because we need a content writer. So Shane, write up some content. And it might be okay, maybe a B minus, but he's never going to be great at it. And so get someone that's great at it. And then you start slicing the work into that. And that hit me that there's so much that can be done when you're shifting your mindset from, I need to count how much headcount I have and how many butts in seat to, do I have the right DNA to execute to the business goals? Business goals, then projects, then people. And not most organizations, by the way, Steve, you know that, I assume. You have people and they're saying, what can we do with the people that we have? Instead of saying, this is what we need, now let's man the seats accordingly.
Yeah. Shahar, I was telling Steve a couple episodes ago, and I'm sure this will resonate with you. when you're building a startup and you're dealing with investors and you're trying to grow, there's one common metric that you always go back to that typically comes up in your investor meetings, and that's revenue per FTE, right? It's this number of revenue per FTE. And Steve and I were talking, like, now that model, like you're playing a big part of that now. Like, how does that, like, you know, because that's a, you know, and you can compound or expand on your knowledge of it, but, you know, there's this $115,000 per revenue FTE. Like, if you're in this, like, you're there, the health of the company, if you're funded, like, we know, like, that's how they're gauging it. So this is disrupting now a lot of, you know, how does a VC look and see,
but,
you know,
it works very well for me now, Shane.
Yes.
Yeah. My company is 45. We're 25 people and 45 freelancers.
Yeah.
Some of them are working a few hours a week. Not all of them are full butts in seats.
Yeah.
And when they ask me what's my headcount, it's like 25. My headcount's 25.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if it's going to work in my benefit, the fact that it's on the podcast, but you're asking me how many employees I have. I have 25.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the others are coming and going, but they're not employees. They don't carry equity. I'm not paying benefits for them. By the way, some of them, I'm paying them a very high hourly rate. They're perfect at what they do. And I'm paying it with all my heart and love. No problem. I'm not trying to use freelancers to cut costs. I'm working with independent contractors because they're the best at what they do.
And there's sometimes the people who they don't want to go to work a full-time job in one place. The reason they're able to be as good as they are is they enjoy trying new things or working on something different every certain amount of time. So yeah, it's absolutely interesting.
Well, keep going. So you're at Kenshu, you're seeing, hey, this model, okay, it took a while to get started, but now we can realize 3x output. And so you're thinking, huh, you know, all right, so keep going.
But then I saw why there's no way for this to work in corporates. Because in this journey, what I started seeing was, you know, a few weeks into the project, I had a freelancer calling me and saying, hey, I'm not taking any more projects with you. I was like, why? So she goes, you guys don't pay. I go, what do you mean we don't pay? She's like, I didn't receive any payment from you for like 3 months. What do you mean you didn't get any payments? It's like, why not? She goes, I don't know. You tell me. It's like, I don't know. Finance didn't pay you. It's like, you know, Steve, how many times have you asked your team, did you get paid this month? You get paid, you kind of assume that people get their payments. It hit me. It's like, I had no idea. You know, I kind of assumed like any other employee, she got paid. So, you know, finance were busy. Invoices were in the mail. It's like, she's just another supplier. Who cares if we pay her now or in 60 days? It's all good. We'll continue doing our work. I had an independent contractor that in November, my head of operation told me, do you know we paid her 80K this year? I was like, what do you mean? We have 40K in my spreadsheet. It says 40K. How do we get to 80? She goes, I don't know. So finance paid her more invoices. It was in line with my budget on the spreadsheet. I had freelancers that never signed a contract. I had the team that was hosting my website contact me. I was a few weeks into the job, and they're like, hey, you know, the guy that was VP marketing before you told us that we'll raise our hourly rate, I don't know, $50 to $70, whatever the number was. And I was like, look, I just got in. I don't know. Let me check the contract and, you know, we'll see if what works. His response was, our contract expired 18 months ago. So don't bother looking into it. So, and then I kind of realized, so the people managing my website, I don't have any agreement with them. They have access to my CRM, which is probably a GDPR breach. And if they decide they can shut down the website in a minute, they don't owe me anything. It's like, this is where I am. And I understood this entire non-payroll workforce is a shit show within organizations. I actually, by the way, since then, I kind of coined the term shadow HR. These are people that are doing work for your company, critical work for your company. They're not managed by anyone. No one knows they're there. No one's tracking them. No one makes sure they're okay. No one, it's like, no one knows. And so they're completely in the shadow. Shane smiling. What up?
Yeah, no, I can resonate with all of this. It's not about me, but I can resonate with all of this in building CCR and going through and having, you know, contract sales staff out of the UK. And, you know, we had a graphic designer that we had here, and we only, you know, we paid him an ongoing retainer, and then we had some people that built our website. And, you know, again, I can resonate with all of this.
And from my experience, that army of people is larger than anyone on the outside ever understands. And so when I see financial reporting or, you know, earnings report, and we have this many people, I'm like, no, you don't. Like, that number means nothing to me. Or unemployment claims or new people on the payroll. I'm like, this is so faulty, the data. And we have no way of tracking that universe. But I think, you know, you're right around it's a hidden cost, but it's also a hidden asset in a way for some people.
It is totally a hidden asset. By the way, the people that are hiring the independent contractors into the organization don't mean any harm. These are usually your best performers. They're trying to get shit done. They're getting people, right. They're driving them, they're giving them tasks, they're managing them. You're absolutely right. The challenge is that the organization, you talk to HR in most organizations, Steve, no, don't take this the wrong way. Most HR don't know, don't care. And I had frank conversations with HR that tell me, I don't want to know. It's a hot potato. I don't want to deal with the non-employees. And so you get into this organization. No one wants to deal with them. Finance is like, oh, we're just paying an invoice. They're a vendor. HR, we don't want to deal with them. And you get this, you know, if you believe the reports, 35, 40% of the workforce within corporates are non-employees. And no one's managing that portion of workforce. And the challenge is not just, are they happy? Are they performing? We're getting into a world where there's IP issues. There's data protection issues. There's tax issues. There's workforce classification. It's like, this is a huge hole in how the company's operating. And so there's the bureaucracy of it. And the other side, this, if a company decides they want to move faster, this is a huge asset to leverage to move faster. And you got to get rid of the bureaucracy and let people move. By the way, you mentioned it earlier. In most organizations that we meet, there's a gap of 3 to 5x between what C-level thinks they have from the number of independent contractors to what they actually have. I spoke to a company.
Say that again. What's the difference?
3 to 5x.
Oh my God.
This is no small. By the way, and some of them, it's like, I asked, how many independent contractors do you have? We don't have many. I was like, well, what about your designers? What about that? Oh, those are consultants. I was like, you realize it's the same thing. I'm serious here. It's like, I talk to companies, by the way, and I tell them on the bureaucracy side again, it's like, how many 1099s have you submitted this year? And they're like, what do you mean? It's like, how many 1099 forms have you submitted to the IRS? It's like, why do we need to do that? Shouldn't the contractors do that? Like, no, you're supposed to submit it on the, it's like, there's so much ignorance in that side of managing a business that it's hard to believe. I spoke to a prospect last week and they're like, we have 324 employees on the payroll. We're about 40 to 50 independent contractors, but there's 486 people accessing our systems. We just don't know who they are and what they do. I was like, okay. So you don't have 50 independent contractors. You have 160 independent contractors. You just don't know what they do.
Right. Wow. Well, Shane and I are smirking at each other because I am that person. Shane is that person. And we'll talk to a CEO and they'll say, can you come in and speak with my team? Or can you help us address something? I said, okay, great. We agree on a contract. And then I start knocking on the door of accounts payable. And that's where it all goes sideways. And so we arrive at the doorstep in the United States with, okay, they haven't asked for the W-9, but they need the W-9. So here's the W-9. Here's all the other pieces they're going to need because we want this payment to come quickly. And then it's like, well, we had one person, I'm not kidding, sent us a 35-page vendor, you know, agreement. Like, this is our terms.
That's right.
I'm like, this is for someone building widgets. I'm not, you know, building widgets. And yes, I believe in all the things that you're saying in there, but this doesn't make any sense.
It's hilarious wasting your time. But
the person delivering it to me was so afraid to go to their legal team and say, this isn't going to work, that they're going to look bad. And so, I mean, it's just getting at the root. And so we're here like, how do we make this easier for them? But the fun part is I get to go back to the CEO and said, oh, you think you're a fast moving, you know, agile organization? Mm-mm. My experience is the opposite. It's a nightmare.
Yeah.
And so I had such a similar experience when I advised between Kenshi and starting the company, I advised a few CEOs. And, you know, I signed the contract with the CEO. And it's like 2 months later, it's like one of the conversations, I was like, hey, you know, who's paying me? And he's like, oh, go talk to accounts payable. I'm like, okay, cool. So we sent an email to accounts payable, and the lady there goes, who are you? And go, well, you know, I'm Shahar, I'm advising your CEO. She goes, have you signed a contract? I was like, yeah, a couple of months back. She goes, can you send it, please? So I send her my copy of the contract. And then mm-hmm. she goes, okay, how do you want to get paid? It's like, I don't know. What are my options? I just what options do I have? What do you mean, how do I want to get paid fast? Is that an option?
Yeah.
And so every month, it's like, hey, am I getting paid this month? And she goes, well, need to check. Oh, you missed the cycle. It's like, I don't want to deal with this.
So kind of circling it back to what we're going through right now, and then we'll kind of dive into the problem that's because I think this will kind of bring it full circle. What you guys actually do. Do we think that this is a time now that's forcing the top down to kind of relook at things and recheck at things? Because like Steve says, you know, we'll get a phone call from a very large company that says, hey, we're in crisis mode. We need somebody to come in and help right away. But by the way, we need you to do that. And then we'll pay you 2 months from now. And it's like this thing.
Right, drop what you're doing and we'll pay you next quarter.
Yeah. So are you seeing, Shahar, are you seeing a change with the people? Like, is it forcing that change?
I think it's forcing that change. I think organization have a dynamic that forces them to move slow.
Yeah.
And so the change is happening, no doubt. I think, you know, Steve wrote Workquake exactly for those reasons. There's no doubt. It has changed. It's not going back. I think what we're seeing and where I built Stoke towards intentionally for what we call mid-market companies. Companies 50 to 2,000 employees where there's one or two decision makers that can decide, we're going to work from this way from here on out. We're going to try this. We're going to start with one team and grow from there. There's enough agility to move forward. Going into enterprises, it's like, you know, it's going to take you 2 years to change their mind. And then another 2 years to actually roll it out within the organization. It's just a matter of how things happen. The second thing is the generational shift has happened. Millennials are the majority of the workforce. In 5 years, Gen Z will be the majority of workforce. And with that happening, they're thinking completely different than how we think. Steve, Shane, you, I, all of us together that, you know, I've been around for a few decades now and have grown up in that enterprise, slow moving enterprise. These people are not thinking like us. They will never have the office experience that we had. Never. For them, the office will be something they walk into every now and again for whatever, I don't know, for a happy hour sometime. And so their ability to build a network of professionals that help them execute to a business goal is far better than anybody that stands in an enterprise right now. And so I do see that change. I have no doubt that the change is happening. I think it's going to start from those smaller companies, like my company, again, 25 employees, 45 independent contractors. And we're seeing it with more and more companies. I think we're 3 to 5 years from seeing that proliferating within enterprises.
Awesome. Well, that's fascinating. And Shahar, what is, do you also have that target customer for your solution because they get it faster than the bigger ones in a way? Like they're going to, like you have a challenge, I would think, and I'm just projecting now. And so correct me if I'm off on this one, that it's hard to sell a solution to a problem someone's not aware that they have. And it's easier.
You're absolutely right.
Like you're saying there's a 3x problem than what you think you have right now. So is that, how do you face that when you're trying to sell?
So you're absolutely right. When I think of my go-to-market, our biggest challenge, people ask me every now and again, it's like, who's your biggest competitor? I say it's Excel and mindset. So we're not running into a solution. We're running into these two problems. You talk to a CFO and it's like, hey, you know, you got a ton of independent contractors. How are you managing them? And their response is, we actually don't have independent contractors. I know, I'm making all the payments. Trust me, we don't have, everyone goes through me. And it's like, they're not going through you. They're going around you. Mm-hmm. And when they start digging, it's like they just start facing reality. A lot of time they don't want to dig, right? It's like no one wants their baby called ugly. But you're right. There's a challenge there. In enterprises, by the way, if you go directly to the hiring manager, to the CMO, when they want to hire an independent contractor, they feel the pain. Because when they want to hire an independent contractor who wants to get paid fast, because otherwise they're not going to work with them, they need to go chase legal. They need to go chase finance. It's like that's work for them. And so we haven't completely cracked because I think it really depends on the person. So if I was telling to myself 2 years ago, I would definitely buy because I felt the pain. There's a lot of organizations that are still not there, are heading towards. And when we talk to them, their first comment is, can you help me hire full-time employees? It's like, you're not hiring full-time employees. The time to hire a full-time employee right now is about 120 days. You have 10 headcounts. That's 1,200 days. You have to decide. You want to hire full-time employees or you want to meet your business goals? The two don't work together. Now figure out what you're going to optimize towards. It's tough to internalize. By the way, I understand why it's tough to internalize. They're like, oh, you're selling me something. I'm not selling you anything. Go read every report. It's like, this is the time it's going to take you to fill in. And assuming you're not going to lose people throughout that period, the world has changed. And it's a tough change. And I think the biggest investments organizations need to have, and that's Steve for you, and maybe it's, you know, volume two of Workweek. I think it's getting the HR organizations to train the frontline managers in managing or building hybrid workforce that has full-time employees and a growing number of non-payroll freelancers, contractor working around the world, project-based, how to qualify them, how to train them, how to onboard them, how to get best results of them, and then in 3 months getting someone else, or 6 months or 9 months, doesn't matter. But understanding that your organization has 30, 40, maybe 60% of the workforce going to be fixed, and the rest is constantly going to change. It's a completely different working model. And that's the most important investment HR organizations need to have in their managers. Managers in 5 years, the best managers will be those that can manage that type of workforce, not the managers that can do the best performance assessment every week or every month of their employees. That doesn't matter anymore.
Yeah. I think you're really onto something, and I hope our listeners really appreciate the depth of what you just heard from Shahar. I really truly believe what's happening now is we are seeing a shrinking of the core of larger enterprises and an expansion for good reasons, for good strategic reasons. I call it sort of the accordion workforce. Like you can expand and contract that gig, you know, independent contractor workforce much easier without the burden, without the PR hit of a layoff. And it's like a shock absorber for you to be able to use. Now, the intellectual property lawyers and the people that say, well, I just spent months training this person, I don't want them to leave, are going to have to reconcile this somehow, because I definitely think this is the way. And the way I phrase it, and I think I wrote this in Workweek, I don't know, it's been a while since I've covered it, but I do believe that the problem we should be solving is how do we create value, not how do we hire people? Like, how do we achieve something? And let's suspend for a second that it doesn't have to be with regular employees. Like, just hold that, like, just suspend. And COVID has given us that chance now. And that's why I'm excited. And I know you're excited by, like, it's the moment where everyone realizes we're going to have to do this differently. And the challenge I'm seeing is people just think it's now. We just have to do it differently now. And then we're going to get back to being able to hire folks. I think that's a big mistake.
I agree. From when COVID started, I had an HR roundtable I hosted back in, I think it's March of last year. And I told them back then, if you're going to treat this as, you know, a phase, you're going to miss out. It's not a phase. It's never coming back to the way it was. Mm-hmm. And, you know, training your people is changing. I think the biggest, how should I call it, misconception that I was raised under or grew up into the industry was I was educated to think that the more people I manage, the I'm more important to the organization. I'm of higher value. I get better titles. I get higher salaries. Right. This is how I was engraved. You know, I grew up in the military, right? So it's like, okay, so you're commander of 2 soldiers, you know, 10 soldiers, right. 40 soldiers. Like, okay, this is our measuring. It's a pyramid, exactly. Mm-hmm. And then you go into corporate. It's like, okay, I'm a team lead. I'm a manager. I'm a director. I'm a VP. It's like, I'm counting how many people I have. And every time, you know, they stay better than Shane and I, you know, together. Every time it's like, okay, we have 20 more people headcount. Everyone starts fighting. Who's getting the headcount? I want the headcount. It's like, that's what we used to fight. I remember myself fighting for headcount. By the way, at some point you reach the age of 40, and then he's like, take my headcount. I don't want any more people. It's like, I don't want any more people. People are headache. And I think, and I think if we can help managers understand, you can be the most impactful manager in the organization, not by the number of people you're managing, but by the business impact you're generating, that is a significant change that the organization can drive. Because then people will start measuring how many headcount they have, and they'll prefer getting the right type of resources to drive the business and not the headcount to drive their title.
Right. Right. I had 2 great conversations. I was sharing this with Shane a couple of days ago in the last week with clients. And it went something like this. What's your biggest problem? Recruiting people. Just can't find people. Can't keep the people. I said, how's your business done during COVID? They go, oh, we're crushing it. We're gaining market share. Things are going really great. They're growing the business. I said, well, why are you looking at your shoes and getting all down in the mouth? Like, you're just doing great. And sounds to me like you're adapting to a more fluid world of work. You're adapting to a more fluid workforce. I said, everyone's losing people and everyone's struggling with that. So maybe now's the way to sort of pat yourself on the back, have a little more confidence and see that maybe what you're striving to measure your success by isn't necessarily true. And you know, to support sort of what you're delivering on, Shahar, I did a post 2 days ago, I think it was, and I called you out or I called Stoke Talent out, and I said, we don't have a recruiting problem in the globe right now. We don't. We do not have a recruiting problem. That is a problem, but it's not the problem. The problem is people are not creative enough on how to find talent to get work done. That's the problem. And they think they've got to recruit them because they think they need a full-time person. And if we had greater creativity, and then you ask them, do you really like doing those performance reviews? No. Do you really like interviewing 20 people and then saying no to 19? No. Then why are you trying to go do something that you don't like, you don't want to do? And as you said, you could get someone probably in there within a week and delivering value in 2 weeks versus 3 months to just to interview the number of people you need to start to make the decision.
It's funny. I was talking to a friend. I'm trying to remember who that was. I remember the conversation. I remember who I had it with 6 or 8 weeks ago. And it's the same thing. You know, I'm spending all these hours. I'm interviewing people. It's very difficult. And you're like, why don't you take a freelancer? He goes, you know, freelancers, the good ones are expensive. And I was like, you're spending 10 hours a week interviewing. You know, what do you make an hour? Exactly. I was like, I make like $200 an hour. So you're spending $2,000 a week interviewing people for zero results, and freelancers are expensive. And he's staring at him. He's like, and he goes like, he's kind of stuck. He's like, I don't know. Is that the same? I was like, it is the same. Your time is super valuable. Take a freelancer, take a contractor. Maybe they're not great. So you spend a week, no progress. That's exactly what's happening right now. Yeah. And it's misconception.
It is. And I think, you know, you said, you know, you can attack HR all you want for me, and I'll probably jump on the bus as much as I will defend. But I think there's systemic inertia that to me, I think the attention on the HR person as the reason this is going to get unlocked, I think is the wrong place to start. We have the way organizations are designed, like you said, the org structure, some more people, more power, more promotion, more people are going to go for that. We also have the way the financial systems, the software is built around FTEs, the way that finance budgets is built around that. Unless that opens up, unless that's delivered in a different way, we're not going to see the downstream shift of HR, you know, deliver, you know, with confidence, hey, we can do this differently, because all these other, how you plan, how Shane, you mentioned it in the first 15 minutes of our broadcast here, the way investors are measuring the quality of investment is an FTE number. So there's all these pieces. The same way I feel like I don't think the gig economy is going to explode. Why? Because health insurance is so jacked up in this country, and good luck getting a health, you know, affordable health care and a home loan. There's all these systemic things that sort of block that from happening. But what I think the force of change is going to be, more people are refusing to be employees now. They're just refusing to be, or they're refusing to adhere to the terms that are required to be an employee. And so that's going to be the friction that's going to lead to, and then there's going to be more stories. Shane, tell the story of your friend. Maybe you've already shared this with Shahar, your friend who got two job offers from the same company.
Yeah,
this is
yeah.
great. So somebody, wondering, Shahar, if you've seen this in other places. So tell them the story.
Yeah. So somebody really close to me, does, marketing work. And, so they got a job with a very, very large company that is valued at a couple large $1 billion numbers that are soon to be go public. So they're trying to fill headcount like crazy, right? They just raised money they're raising money right now at a $32 billion valuation. So wow. a lot of money, a lot of headcount, thousands of people they're trying to hire, fill these seats, right? So he goes through the interview process, gets a job offer. They give him two offers. They give him, and I'm going to make up some numbers here to not kind of put their personal business out there.
Do proportional, you know, be proportional,
yes,
whatever.
Yes, yes. So let's say they gave him an offer for $200,000 to be an employee, and we're going to give you $200,000 in the value in shares, and we're going to give you benefits and all those things that come along with being an employee. At the same time, they gave him a parallel offer. They said, or we'll give you $240,000 in shares. You take care of your benefits, and then we'll cover any essential travel that has to happen if we have to do that to be a contractor. So
you choose.
So he had never went through this process, and you know, wasn't never been in the startup world. He's like, well, what's the difference? And I'm like, well, you want to travel more. You want to have the freedom to do whatever you want to do. You know, what you disliked about the previous place that you worked was, you know, the rules and the confinement and the, you know, slow speed to get things done. This is now putting you in that realm, and the valuation is going to go up here. So this was at a previous valuation when he came in, and I said, and you're getting more stock, right? Like, so there's the upside to that. So he's like, I don't need insurance because my spouse has insurance on her. And so I don't need that. Like, so there's money there. I'm like, yeah. He's like, so I really can do this job from anywhere. I was like, they don't care if you're in the North Pole, as long as the work gets done, like that's it. So that's what he did. Yeah. So that's what he
took the independent route. Yeah. And that's it. Have you seen that other places do that, Shahar? I haven't heard of that.
No, I haven't seen anybody kind of saying you can do this or that. I can tell you myself, when I started the company, I had two freelancers. One of them is my graphic designer. She's still with us. I was just able to convince her to become an employee. In Israel, the tax structure is different. So granting equity for non-employees, they pay a higher tax bracket. So it's not exactly equivalent, to Shane's point. So they have a benefit in actually turning into an employee from a tax benefit perspective. And she was our independent contractor with us for 2 years. And another guy that was a software engineer. And they both worked for like 3 or 4 days a week. And she was pretty expensive back then compared to the industry benchmark 3 years ago. And for me, it was a very easy decision. She's a freelancer. I'll pay her the high rate. If she's good, she's worth it. If she's not, I'm not going to even have her stick around for the lower rates. Like, if she's good, she's worth it. I'll pay along. So she was with us for 2 or 3 months. I was like, hey, and you know, why don't you come in employee? And she, you know, I could use you 5 days a week. And she was like, no, I'm never going to be an employee. Yeah. Like, why not?
I've met her, Steve. Yeah.
Oh, cool.
And she goes, because if you piss me off, I'm gone the next day. And she says it to my face. It's like, she doesn't blink. She doesn't like, it's like, if you piss me off, I'm gone the next day. It's like, I'm doing this because I like it. I don't want to feel I need to do this because I'm concerned you're going to fire me.
Wow.
And so,
that's so
and
honest.
I think
that's
that,
raw. Yeah.
And I think this is exactly what's, people are missing today. Everyone's calling their employees now talents, right? That's kind of the new trend. Everyone's a talent. Everyone's a rising star. Mm-hmm. I think that the best talent today is choosing the freelance route. They can determine their destiny. They can determine their own pay grade, right? You know this. You and I worked at corporate. It's like you got pay bands in corporate. Italian doesn't have a pay band. Yeah, one of them can be $150 an hour. The other can be $350 an hour. How do you match that into a corporate pay band? And so we're moving to a world where the best of the best will pick that route. They can advise multiple companies. They can provide different services. They can work from anywhere, to your point, Shane. It's like that's the flexibility they will take. Doesn't mean they don't work. Doesn't mean they don't work hard. They actually bring the biggest value to the organization. And organizations need to be able to recognize the fact that their highest performers are not their employees.
Yeah.
There are a lot of different people.
I think figuring this out is going to be a competitive advantage, right? In a mid-sized company, you know, it's 2021. Your competitive advantage is your IP, or you really don't have one. And then it's who can go to market fastest. You know, it's these different things, right? This is one of the rare times where you actually can develop a real competitive advantage to figure this out and to move. And, you know, I was just talking to a company that had reached out and looking to bring Steve in and provide some feedback. And, you know, and they're like, well, you know, we're trying to do this, but, you know, people are telling us, they're like, you know, you keep waffling on your coming back into office strategy. And, you know, I really don't want to come back into the office. And you told us eventually we're not going to have a choice. So I called this company over here and they're going to let me do that. And they're going to pay me $60,000 more a year. So good luck. I appreciate everything you've done. And they're like, what do we do? Right? Like, I literally have no response to that. So my thing is I'm curious. We have a really interesting audience that pays attention to the show. They are, to be honest, they're the exact demographic of Shahar, what you're hoping to influence and change and support and help as this becomes something at scale. What would you say to those people who are maybe either unaware or sitting around in these board meetings and they're trying to figure out, like, we have a problem here that needs to be fixed? And they don't even know that they're spending the time deliberating how to fix the problem when someone literally could be working overnight while they're sleeping, fixing the problem.
So I think there's really, it's almost one of those things that are staring in your face. You can't hire fast enough. You can't find the talent. And the number of independent contractors is growing three times faster compared to traditional employees. It's like, it's not super difficult to connect the two dots. It's like, okay, there's a lot of talent here. Now, how do we start leveraging it? I think that's the question. It's not that if you keep asking, how do we recruit faster, recruit better, you're not going to find a solution. You're going to do exactly the same thing as the other 500,000 companies are trying to do. You got to think differently of the problem, and it is staring you in the face. There's a ton of independent contractors out there. Start experimenting. Empower your managers. Tell them, hey, you know what? You have 10 people. That's your headcount now. Take 10 or 20% of that. The value of two heads, that's your budget for freelancers. Start hiring freelancers. It's okay. You're going to fail. The first two hires, couple of hires, not going to work. Start training. Train your brain. Train your team. Learn how to work with them. And over time, it'll become easier. And that will become your power. I'm not telling you stop hiring employees. Keep hiring employees. Even if you're going to try and hire the entire 10, it's going to take you a year. So in the midst of it, start putting budgets into freelancers and force the teams to start experimenting. I have everyone in my organization. I'm a small organization, not very large budgets. Obviously, we're a startup. Everyone in my team knows they use our system. We eat our own dog food. Everyone has $2,000 available in the system for them every month to go, and anything they can outsource, anything they get as a thing they need to do, go and outsource. If you can outsource, go, and we ask them, it's like, why aren't you doing that more? It's like anything that's not, you know, core IP, not some knowledge that we have to keep in the organization, go outside. Go ahead, Shane. Sorry.
Okay. No, I want to dive into this for a second. Steve, did you pick up on what he said?
Yeah. Right,
Okay. I want to dive into this for a second. So for those that weren't, maybe you're driving and you weren't paying super close attention, you have $2,000 for every employee set aside for them to help you find holes in the boat and clog the holes as you move and continue to progress on. So you're, and then you tell, you're telling me when they don't spend that money, you then actually want to figure out why they didn't spend the money, or why they didn't, why they didn't outsource something.
That's going exactly. in my next presentation.
Oh, mm-hmm.
yeah.
Shahar,
let me try and turn. Let me try to turn it around. Let me try to turn it around for a second. Right. So say you're running a sales organization, right? You're asking them, why don't you have more meetings? Why do you have holes in your calendar? Why aren't you promoting that account? You ask that question. Same thing here. I have super talented engineers. Why are they doing work that can be done elsewhere? Anything that we can push outside to multiply and accelerate our go-to-market, do it. It's worth that budget. And if I ended up, you know, paying an engineer $120 an hour instead of $100, so be it.
Mm-hmm. Man, mm-hmm. And here's the thing. I just saw, and this is how this relates, I think. And Steve, you tell me if I'm totally missing it, because you've literally lived in the halls of these big companies. Right now, there's an article and this whole narrative going around business travel. Corporations are killing business travel. So with that budget that you typically spent to fly your teams all over the place, and you have allotted money sitting out there that you could solve these hiring problems that's sitting there on the balance sheet in some form or fashion. And you talk about this, Steve, so much. Really, mm-hmm. you know, there's so many nuggets within WorkQuake. It's wild, almost, the fact of the things you've hit on. But one of the things you hit on is leadership in today's world. The companies that are going to win the next 10, 15, 20 years are the companies who adapt an experimenting mentality, right? Mm-hmm. An experimenting process. So if we know we typically have this money that we spend, and we know we have these things that need to be solved, and HR is telling us, look, I'm doing all I can, we're 18 months from having this headcount filled. There's not a shortage of freelancers. There's not a shortage of people who can literally, I just posted a job on Upwork less than 12 hours ago, and I've got 126 people who've either commented or bid on. Of all qualified people that are ready to start going, and to Shahar's point, okay, if they don't do it well, I'm out $200. Right, because you can figure out really quick if somebody's going to be able to do it or not. It's wild to think. How does am I wrong?
But your opportunity to qualify that candidate on a platform that's got Uber 5-star ratings is much better than your vague referral phone calls for 6 people who don't want to get sued, so they're going to give you vanilla. And so you've got a higher index, but you also have I don't think there's any way that we can, you know, qualitatively say this is a fact, but I do believe it to be true. The quality of the people moving to independent work is growing. The pool's growing, and so is the quality. So I think there's a lot more proportionally great talent sitting there. And I'm starting to use these words now, like, shame on us if we don't at least try to see what that's about. That there's a different angle in this. I want to hit sort of like I'm going back to my closed-minded HR days when I didn't see the world the way that I do now. And I would say, well, Shahar, you know, I don't want to have a lot of these contracts because how am I going to manage my culture with all these mercenaries running around? Like, how do you handle that conversation when someone comes at you with that feedback?
To be completely frank, I don't think I have a very good answer about managing culture. I think managing culture is a challenge regardless of freelancers today. Most companies are in a world where their employees are remote anyway. Most of the companies talking about culture have an attrition problem or people leaving after 18 months. And so I think we got, over the last 5, maybe 10 years, we confused culture with bringing pets to the office. It's not exactly the same thing. The culture you want in your organization is a culture of execution, camaraderie, that's driving business results. That's culture. And that's not changing when you're bringing on independent contractors. That's still part of it. You still want people to respect each other, but happy hour beers, dogs at the office, it's all great. Do it if you want, but that's not culture. And so I think you can still have the culture that you're looking for from a business perspective.
And you got me thinking, Shahar, like, I think this is going to be, this is an article or this is a blog ready to happen, because I've been saying since COVID started, every company culture's changed and nobody's talking about it. Like, every culture's changed because of COVID, and no one's really, well, what's our culture? Well, it wasn't what it was. And I'm dealing with people going back to the office going, we're all the same group of people coming back, but we are not the same culture. Like, what happened? And I'm like, yeah, the person that left is not the person coming back. And so I think you're right. Like, maybe this is the moment where we need to reimagine that. What is culture, right? Like, what is it? Like, what? And I've always said to business leaders, like, please don't talk about culture if you don't care about it. Because if someone thinks you do and you say all these things and you do the opposite, you're doing more harm than just saying, I don't really care about all that stuff. This is what we're about. So just be honest about it. And I think the reason why we talk about it is because we think if we have a good one, we're going to achieve better results. But it's about the results. Just like I hear people say, HR is here to make people happy. And I go, no, they're not. We're here to win. It just so happens happy people tend to win more, but the goal isn't happy. The goal is winning. So just be mindful of that, because they're always like, oh, happy days and, you know, being nice. No, that's not what it's about.
I agree.
Go ahead, Shahar. Go ahead.
No, I just want to say, for me, culture, again, not using big words and a lot of, you know, the things you write on poster that have nothing to do with reality. At the end of it, culture is show respect to each other, listen, make quick decisions. These are the things that make a culture. And they have nothing to do with whether I'm paying you through a paycheck or through an invoice.
Right. What were you thinking, Shane?
Steve, let me ask you this. Mm-hmm. This is one of those things that you really can't quantify, but when there's a hiring crisis or it's hard to hire, right? So when you're trying to fill a bunch of seats, that typically means that there's extra work being put on the people that are there, right? So in reality, there could be a negative effect by not being able to be creative and fill your talent void. So there's a negative effect on your culture. Because now we're dumping extra work. Mm, there's more pressure.
I see where you're going.
So kind of to Shahar's point, it's like, okay, you don't know that it's like this actually is impacting your culture. So you asked me, how does this affect my culture? Well, how much extra work and how many extra hours that your people aren't getting paid overtime for that they're busting their hind end to do? How's that? Like, how many people, like, have you checked in?
Right.
So now all of a sudden there is, so I think that's where the tie-in is to be able to fix this, because we also all know it happens in our personal life when as a marriage in our household, if financial issues aren't an issue, marriage is pretty good. Life is pretty good. Life, you know, we plug along. The moment finances become an issue, the moment extra workload or something happens, what happens? Now all of a sudden I'm mad because you left the towel on the floor in the bathroom. I'm upset because you didn't take the trash out and you didn't do the dishes last night. And you know, these things happen. Winning solves a lot of this. Winning kind of makes culture a fraction less relevant, right? Because it's like, okay, we're winning. Everybody's happy. Like, things are good. Right.
Yeah. Right? I love where you're going with this, Shane. And I think about a moment, my early days at LinkedIn, where the engineering team typically would send a note out at 3 a.m. on Sunday saying, hey, we just really updated the site with this new code. Wow. Victory. Thank you to all the people. And I walked into my CEO's office and I said, we're going to fly right off the cliff if this keeps going on. Like, this is not good, because what's happening is someone's not spending time with their spouse. Someone's not spending time with their kids. And he's like, well, you've got the hardest job in the company because all our problems are people problems. I said, well, you've got the hardest job in the company because we're LinkedIn. And if the world knows that we can't recruit and our biggest product is recruiting, like, we're in a whole world of hurt. And so anyway, that's how I got the gray hair. But I think you're onto something, Shane. Like, I kind of want to start selling for you, Shahar, because I think this is it. Like, don't talk to me about culture. Talk to me about the culture that's happening, because you're not able to, you're using an old model. Talk to me about that culture, right?
I need to drop the mic now, and my mission was accomplished. I get Steve now selling us. So now, Shane, say no more. It can only go south from here.
But think about this, Shahar. Like, I'm not telling you. I mean, you're obviously you're very self-aware, but you can market to people you're hiring as, we're not only going to hire you, I'm going to give you $2,000 a month to help you hire other people to help take the workload off and to free your time up and to free your stress up. That's bananas. I'm telling you right now, we'll talk off air about some ideas that I've jotted down here that I think you can kind of run with that. But man, Steve, yeah,
That's a big move. And
so I will tell you the other part. There's a gap there. And again, I'm a very open person. 80% of my team is challenged in doing that because they've never been trained in finding freelancers. Yeah. Yeah. They've never been trained of offloading work. When you get work, what do? You start working. It's like, don't start working. Start thinking, what are you going to do? And what are you going to push outside? Our minds are not engraved that way. Right. There is a shift that needs to happen within individuals as well.
But that also goes to the unwritten rules in a corporate world of, my boss doesn't see me working. It's the same way what Steve's running into of, like, do you not trust your employees, you know, do you not think they're actually going to do the job, or do you need to actually be in an office and see them working to fulfill your own need? Right. So it's that thing of that fear of, well, am I less valuable? Because in reality, so what Shahar is saying and what the market's saying is if you're able to hire and efficiently bring in freelancers really fast, you probably have the most valuable, you know, position in any company right now.
And I think that HR's part of HR's role into the future, and Steve, again, Workweek Volume 2, every HR organization needs to have a flexible workforce manager, call it whatever you want, that helps the organization train that muscle of building a proportional sized, flexible workforce, build your own talent cloud, people that can constantly come and support your business that are not on your fixed payroll.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think we haven't even talked about this, what I'm about to say right now in this whole episode. We've just assumed that this is no longer an issue, but there used to be a stigma if you were a temp. There was a stigma if you're kind of, not good enough to be. And now it's like flipped
180 degrees.
You're an employee.
People tell you when to come to the office. People tell you how much you're going to make. Exactly. Yeah.
This is one of those moments where we talk about the Uber, you know, yellow cab could have been Uber before Uber, Marriott, they could have been Airbnb. The huge temporary agencies could have been Stoke Talent or Upwork if they would have innovated, because they had all the people. They had all the people who needed work and who are looking for work and are looking to do all they had. They had the model. They had the relationships. They had the infrastructure. They have those things. It's wild. Right.
It is.
Oh, right. Man.
They got used to making their income the way they did, and they didn't face in how the organization's changing. By the way, all hosting companies. Steve remembers that when LinkedIn started, right? It's like we were all hosting our in data centers. None of them became Amazon.
That's right.
None of the data centers even tried to become Amazon. They're a milking cow.
Yeah. We had one of the sites that we used to invoice, to do electronic signatures was down yesterday, and we needed to get some contracts signed. And they're like, Amazon. So they were like totally putting it on Amazon. I was like, what? And I said, you didn't send me an email. You didn't send me a note. The site's down. You didn't give me an alternative path here. I discovered it through Shane, who did some trolling through some Twitter posts and found out their site was down or something. I don't even know how we found out.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it is crazy.
So Shahar, we'll kind of bring this back in. You know, a couple things. One, how, if there's HR folks, there's leaders or CEOs that are like, you know, they're listening to this and they're like, well, shit, I need to pay my employees $2,000. Like, how do I bring this guy in to help us solve this problem? Cause that's ultimately what you guys do. How can people find you, and what's the best way to reach out? Cause I'm guessing you guys kind of do like and if you don't do this, cut me off, but you guys do some sort of deep dive when you connect with a company to kind of see their pain points and see what, you know, kind of what they need.
Yeah. Yeah. We have a conversation, obviously. Yes. Okay. You know, you can reach us on stoketalent.com. I'm sure when this goes live, you'll be able to find us on social media. Can email me directly, Shahar@stoketalent.com. Happy to take any of those. Again, no intention to make this a promotional podcast, but happily.
But we, first of all, we
want what you're doing. Yes. We want people to know about it. Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. The amount of people that we've told in private conversations about you and other things. You know, obviously we haven't had any guests because we don't want it to make a, we won't have anybody on here that we genuinely don't, wouldn't support and wouldn't get behind if cause we have nothing to gain from this. So we only want to amplify you because you're solving a problem that is in the world of problems we're trying to solve. So,
yep.
Humble.
All right.
Thank you.
Well, listen, let's let Shahar get to his 10 PM or 10:30 PM meeting that's coming up. And I want to, on behalf of Shane and I, thank you for being our first guest. It's been great. And I feel like, and the guests are going to want us to continue the conversation. I can't wait to hear the feedback, but I learned a lot. Looking forward to hearing from you again in the future. Shane, what other closing thoughts do you have here?
No, I think this has been great. I think I'm just kind of playing out from a content perspective. I think what I want to do is anyone who's listening that potentially has this problem, and maybe you would like to maybe come on an episode, maybe with Shahar, and then you can figure, like, we can kind of play it out. He can ask some questions about why you're not doing these things, or if you've got some pushback, like maybe we can kind of create some dialogue and open, because that's ultimately what it is, right? If we're going to solve any issue, we have to be able to have open dialogue and open conversations around it. But Shahar, listen, thanks so much for joining us. Thanks for accommodating on your time zone and on your end.
It's been a privilege, guys.
Yes.
It's been a privilege. I enjoyed every second. I'm looking forward to, I'm sure we'll continue collaborating. We have a very similar vision to where we're seeing the industry is going. So, cool. Thank you.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, that's a wrap, everybody. Yeah. Another episode of the Work Week After Hours with our first and famous guest, Shahar Arez. Look forward to your feedback, your comments. Please like, share, give us a positive rating on wherever you're listening to your podcasts. And we'll look forward to seeing you on the next episode.
Cheers.